This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Today's Talk of the Nation is part of Think Global, Public Radio's week of special coverage on globalization. And if there's one point a person can take away from the discussions on globalization this week, it is that the world is smaller than it once was, and that around the globe our economies and our lives are linked in ways that weren't before. So to understand where we're headed, people in free societies by and large turn to the press for information. And we'd like to think the news media give us facts and ideally the context to draw our own conclusions about the world around us. But is the media keeping up? Do the newspapers, magazines, and programs we rely on for news adequately reflect our changing world? And is the perspective of the media itself becoming more global? Now, to be sure, sources like CNN and Reuters, not to mention NPR, have long dispatched journalists to remote parts of the world, and more recently, non-Western news networks like Al Jazeera have emerged into the media marketplace. At the same time, though, if you pick up your local paper, chances are much of that is devoted to news about the school board or flap over downtown development. And those are important issues, to be sure. But as the global community becomes more interconnected, how much should we know about life in other parts of the world? Later in the program, a conversation with journalist Peter Bergen about his new article on Jack Adema, the American who ran a private prison in Afghanistan and ended up in one that is quite publicly funded. First, how global is your news? We want to hear from journalists and editors in our audience. How much time and space do you devote to covering world events? And if you're a consumer of news, how much time would you devote and do you devote to international news? How hard is it for you as an American to find international news if you are terribly interested? Does it have any relevance in your daily life? Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at TOTN at NPR.org. So to start off the conversation, we turn to Mark Nykirk. Mark is managing editor of the Cincinnati Post and Kentucky Post and joins us by phone from his office in Ohio. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So what's the lead story in the paper today?
The lead story today, well, we actually do two papers, one for a Cincinnati audience, and then we're right on the border, and we also have a Kentucky paper, and the lead stories are different. In Cincinnati, the lead story is on hospitals and how local hospitals and how they're making their ends meet, and whether we've had a lot of instances where the an ambulance taking somebody to the hospital can't go to the nearest one and has to be sent elsewhere, sidetracked elsewhere, and that's our lead story today. And right after that is a story about a city councilman who's in trouble with the law.
All right, and those are important to people have to know about those stories, certainly. Key stories. How do you decide how much of your paper is devoted to international events?
We are going to start most every day by saying, what do we have locally? The world sort of competes against local news on our page one. Now, we do have in the A section, which is the front section, a second page that's devoted daily to national and international news, labeled Nation and World, and you expect a daily summary there of other headlines from around the world, as well as just the news hole inside that A section.
So you're going to have a summary
day to day.
Yeah. So maybe a summary of world events on stories that may not be the top headlines, and then if there's something in the Middle East or some other story, Darfur, for instance, perhaps explodes, a little larger story, a little bigger story in the A section.
Right. On any given day, a story from around the world might have the legs to and just sort of the, in our judgment, general public interest to make the cut on page one. A lot of times it depends on what's happening locally also.
How do you gauge that interest?
I think we're trying to keep up with the breaking news and on those inside stories, but if something just lasts a little longer and begins to feel like it has more interest or more impact, and then it gets a little more space and a little more play. And the other factor is what's the local connection to an international story? We have Procter & Gamble here, and Procter & Gamble's growth is hinged on expanding in the world markets. An airport that's connected to to the world and international airport. So a lot of business stories might drive our interest in a international story.
So are stories about globalization likely to make your paper?
About globalization?
About the phenomenon itself, yeah.
Yes.
And what about, to what extent, you talked about the local connection, how important is that in deciding whether or not an international story gets space?
It's sort of like any news in the paper, how the newspaper's trying to reach a general audience. Does this story have currency with a lot of people or just a fairly narrow audience? Procter & Gamble's involved, it's likely to affect more people. Some things might just be quirky and interesting. We have interesting to a wide audience. There's a company, for example, that sells kind of an obscure thing, but sells bands that go on birds around the world. So, you know, if we're writing about that, we might take a look at what their market is and how they market globally. But things like that.
Let's go to the phones now. We're talking today about getting your international news. Where do you get it from? How important is it to you as a consumer of news? We're also talking to people in the news business about whether or not it's important to their news organization, how they gather the news, and what perspective we tell the news from. Cindy is on the line from Akron, Ohio. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
You have a question for us?
You know what? Every day since September 11th, I turn on the TV, and I listen to 1,000 million cable channels and try to get something. So finally, my paper in Akron is the Akron Beacon Journal. You're talking to Cincinnati. He knows who where you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
I finally got the New York Times Daily during the week. I read everything that they report globally. And when I can't find what I need, I go online to BBC.
Well, tell me, Cindy, let me ask you, interrupt you for a moment and ask you what it is you think you need. What are you looking for in international news that you don't seem to be finding?
Well, I think it's important. We all talk about, you know, why do they hate us? I think we need to understand the world. And until we understand the depth of poverty and the depth of hopelessness that most of these people feel in Africa. We support a lot of regimes because of oil. These people are living in real poverty. We do not know what that means. I support, through an organization, a little girl in India. This child would probably be, I don't know, she would be farmed out or something. I don't know.
Cindy, I want to get a response because you've said a few things that I think would be very interesting, and I'd like to have Mark Nykirk respond to them, the managing editor at the Cincinnati Post. Thank you very much for your call. Number one, are you worried about losing readers like Cindy?
Well, we worry about losing readers, sure. I do also think that people, realistically now, we know that people look online for news. Obviously, we have, like every newspaper, an online presence. But it's a little like before the Internet. If you want to know about the world, you read the newspaper, but you also go to the library, and every citizen has a responsibility to look more than one place. It's the news is event-driven, and we all learned a lot more about the area hit by the tsunami than we did know about that area before that weather event. That forces us, draws our attention to an area, and we begin to look at things. I think what she is saying with regard to understanding other people is important, and we think that's part of our role. Columnist and op-ed pieces address that often. If something's in the news of that lasts a while, you're more likely to see an explainer story with it to sort of bring you into this piece of the world.
Well, Mark, you've raised two points that I would like to put to our next guest. Oliver Boyd Barrett is a professor of communications at California State University in Pomona, California. Oliver, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon.
This question that Mark has just raised, one of them is about sources, about people sort of being free to and encouraged to search out other sources to slake their needs for news. What kind of sources are out there? You've written extensively on the globalization of media. Are there a variety of sources?
Sure. The first thought that comes to my mind when listening to Mark is, in a way, how things haven't changed so much. Mark didn't expressly refer to the wire services, but I would bet that Associated Press is going to be a very significant source of both national and international news for Mark, and AP is a cooperative of approximately 1,500 daily U.S. newspapers, and it is a very significant source of news for them. For most of them don't field their own correspondents in overseas countries, or if they do, just a very very small number. So one thing I take from Mark is that in this respect, globalization or not, at the local level, things don't seem to have changed that much. So secondly, the second thought I have is that, as Mark rightly says, is that there are many more sources in that we can access through the web. So that has changed, that we do have, as news consumers, we have access to, I'm tempted to say, an infinitely broader range of sources than we used to.
Is there a problem of vetting and credibility, though?
Yes, that's one issue. Many of these sources that we can access over the internet do not have the branded, if you like, the branded credibility and trustworthiness that people often attribute to the mainstream media. But we can also use the internet wisely to access other brand name sources. We could use it to access stories from Reuters, for example, or Bloomberg, or even Agence France-Presse, which is the French language, well, not only French language, but the
French-based
international agency.
I want to talk more about this, about the sources, where they come from, the cultural biases, if there are any, and whether or not we can trust the news we get abroad, and if it's becoming more global. We'll take your phone calls at 800-989-8255. This is part of Think Global, Public Radio's week of special coverage. I'm Frank Stacio. This is Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. How global is your news? Is your primary source of information the local paper, television, the internet, NPR, giving you the global coverage you need? You can give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at this address, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Oliver Boyd Barrett, professor of communications at California State University in Pomona, California, author of the book The Globalization of News. And before the break, we were talking about the sources of news. Most of the sources, in fact, all of the sources you mentioned, were Western-based sources. These are sources in Western countries. If I'm looking for news about other cultures, can I trust that a bias hasn't been worked in to those sources?
Well, I think that is a big question, Frank. Interestingly, it's been a question that's been around for a long time, because before we had organizations like CNN and BBC World, we had the wire services, just mentioned Associated Press, we had Reuters, Agence France-Presse, and these are organizations that go back more or less directly to the mid-19th century. And almost from the days that those organizations became powerful as gatherers of news around the world and as sellers of news around the world, there were worries from different countries that these sources might be bias. We might want to say today, we might want to say that the worry was that they were too ethnocentric in the take that they had on the world. And so quite frequently, from time to time, you had attempts to counter the influence of the Reuters and the Associated Presses, sure, with the development of new forms of collaboration based in non-Western countries. Not many of those succeeded. Actually, Originally, UP, that was the organization that the forerunner to UPI. UP was a kind of a resistor to what was then called the news cartel. This is the beginning of the 20th century. And then later on, Associated Press withdrew from the cartel, and it too joined this radical group, saying, you know, we're fed up with a world news flow that's dominated by these Europeans. We want our own voice. And sorry, Frank, go ahead.
No, I want to go to the phones for a moment, and thank you for that. Drew is on the line from Dutch Harbor, Alaska. Hello, Drew.
Hi there.
You have a question for us?
Excuse me?
You have a question?
I'm sorry, there's quite a delay in the phone line is going this distance.
Go ahead with your question, Drew.
Well, I'm the managing editor of the paper out here in the Aleutian Islands, I just want to point out that for these local papers, this is a very small weekly, and I just come from a daily, we're very much dependent on those wire services and the Associated Press. And, you know, while they are cooperatives, and we do have some interaction with local editors at the AP, they really have at times a face of a kind of an overwhelming, distant organization. And we're dependent on what they decide is worthy international news and how they cover it. And I don't even know if our local editors have that much input into the way the international coverage works.
It's a good question. It seems to me that if you're relying on, say, two wire services or one in the case of some newspapers, one wonders about the blanket or the depth of the coverage, Oliver.
Yes, it's a very interesting comment that we've just heard from that. Associated Press, it needs to be said, despite the problems that have been referred to, it is quite an unusual model. It is quite an unusual structure, that cooperative structure. And although it may be a flawed structure, I suspect that when you compare it with some of the other providers of global news, you find even less connectivity, if you will, between the central organization and the customers or the clients. But it's interesting to hear certainly that even a cooperative structure may not be as responsive as people would like it to be to information needs, to news needs at the local level.
Thanks for your call, Drew. You know, one organization that's been at it for quite a while is the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC. A veteran in the international news business, Richard Sambrook is the CEO of BBC World and director of BBC's Global News Division, and joins us now by phone from the Toronto airport. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Frank.
Tell us a little bit. We got into this whole business of cultural bias and sort of how you choose news stories. How has the BBC managed this question over the years?
Well, it is a very complicated question, I think there are a number of factors. Firstly, we broadcast in 43 languages, and obviously, if you're broadcasting to a country in its own language, then your news agenda, if you like, is going to be tailored to the interests of that country. But we also broadcast in English, in radio and in television, and now, of course, we have the internet as well, and that's a global service, and therefore not tailored to any one set of interests or of national interest in any way. And all of these things is like any other form of news judgment, really. It's an art and not a science, but you have some criteria by which you try to make the information as tailored or as relevant to whatever audience you're trying to address. The difficulty for a big global service like CNN International or BBC World is it is literally a global audience. And for the BBC, that goes back, we have a kind of tradition now going back 80 years, that for those global services, we try and think of ourselves, if you like, as looking down on the world from 30,000 feet. We don't try and project British interests particularly. I'm sure some people would say that we can't avoid that, and we're bound to have some kind of British interests wrapped up in our selection. But we don't try and project British interests. We try and take a kind of neutral global take on international events.
But when you say a global audience, I mean, it really isn't a global. If we think about that, we think about people in their fields, people in their offices all around the world. But you as a broadcaster have to have an audience in mind in order to target the message somehow, to fashion that message.
Yeah,
who are you thinking? Who do you think is out there?
Audiences. and this is where it gets complicated. In some senses, of course, we are sometimes a lifeline service in parts of Africa, in villages in Asia, or in countries that are going through a crisis in Iraq or more recently in Afghanistan. We've become at times the staple source of information. At the other end of the scale, like NPR, the BBC's audiences in North America, the most kind of media-saturated society in the world, our audiences are growing at the minute because what we're offering in terms of a global agenda is very different from what people can get anywhere else in that market. So for those people who want that, they know where to come and find it. And in the middle, there are, of course, the developing countries, and Asia is the primary example of this, which are very fast, very rapidly developing their own media. India is a good example. India now has, I think it's 43 news channels of its own. And there we have to find our own place in terms of not trying to report India to the Indian population, but trying to report global issues which have some relevance and resonance in that country.
Oliver Boyd Barrett, you hear what BBC is going through, struggling with this changing environment, this global environment. Overall, is that the picture? Do you find the old standards are having to adjust, and what kind of adjustments are they making?
Yes, I think this is, I suspect that this is still a process of transition. This is a relatively new phenomenon. Broadcasters that have, if not global reach, certainly very impressive reach across many, many different nations. And I think this is still a process of transition, still a process of learning how best to tailor new services to such an incredibly complex and heterogeneous market. The BBC World does have perhaps an advantage in as much as it came out of, it sprang from the older BBC World service, the radio service that was, Richard used the term lifeline, but was regarded by many people in the ex-British colonies and elsewhere, parts of the developing world, often countries which suffered under fairly, very authoritarian regimes, that the BBC World Service, being a radio service, did achieve fairly spectacular reach into populations of some of those countries with a much less biased or a much less censored or controlled account of what was going on in the wider world.
Okay.
So, so the BBC, as I say, I think that is an advantage that it enjoys. In a way, it's even more complex for some of the other players, like CNN.
We have an email that asks the question, well, it makes the observation that when I travel out of the country, CNN advertises for shows about the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. Programs are not available in the U.S. Why? Ellen wants to know.
I think that's a marketing judgment that CNN makes with respect to what it believes that its viewers, its consumers in the United States expect and want and are used to. And I expect the logic runs along the lines of, well, in the United States, there isn't that much of a demand for an international or a global perspective, that people are much more interested in local and national issues. And that, I think, is, and I'm sure Richard and others would speak much more professionally or could speak in much greater depth about this, but that seems to me to be the real challenge, is that people's information needs are locally situated. People are situated in local cultures, and they want news, they want information which speaks to them as being so situated. So it's a very difficult judgment, a very difficult call, I feel.
They are locally situated in an ever more interconnected world, and so as we heard from our first caller, it was very important to her to hear about what's happening in other places to understand why certain things may be happening in the U.S. So I will put the question to you, Richard. In the end, it does become a marketing problem, doesn't it? It becomes a question of, will they watch this if I put it on?
Well, of course it does. I don't think it's simply a marketing issue. It's about trying to serve your audiences in the best way that you can. But you're absolutely right that there is this kind of tension between the local and the global. And what audiences want is global news with a local resonance, or they want to understand the global significance of what's happening locally to them. And to the extent that broadcasters are able to encompass that tension, I think they can be more successful. And that really means trying to regionalize services where you're able to, at least at certain times of the day, in order to be able to kind of bridge that local-global span. I mean, I think the other thing that you were talking a little earlier about whether there's a kind of domination of Western global broadcasters and so on. But the other thing that's happening that's relevant to this is, of course, new voices are coming on the scene, and we've seen that particularly with Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and new broadcasters in the Middle East who are very well funded and privately funded by and large. But also, as I was saying before, in parts of Asia, there's now a very dynamic local media growing, which it seems to me is going to break out sooner or later in a global sense. And of course, on the internet, the barriers to entry, the cost to entry in terms of internet news services are now very low indeed. So I do think, you know, we are, as Oliver was saying, at a point of transition, and I do think we are at a point where we are going to see a mushrooming of different voices and different regional voices coming out and being available around the world.
All right, let's go to the phones, and Myra's on the line from Hudson, Ohio. Hi, Myra.
Hi, it's actually Mira.
I'm sorry, Mira, go ahead.
That's okay. I was thrilled to hear about your topic. I think that newspapers can and need to be they can be a very effective tool for international education. I think that we as Americans all need to be educated about other countries, and not just the stories we mostly hear in the media are stories about poverty and how difficult people's lives are in developing countries. But I think the print media needs to do more in sharing positive stories, focusing on different communities, what they're doing to confront different issues. It could be environmental, it could be economic. But sharing, as I said earlier, positive stories, and not to always just portray that people in India or South American countries or Africa are just poor and pathetic, their lives are pathetic. But
well, let me put that question to Richard Sambrook of the BBC first, and I want to thank you, Mira, for your call. Richard?
I absolutely agree with that, and I think portrayal, particularly of developing countries, is a very important, and I think in some ways an increasingly important issue. It's something we think very hard about within the BBC. Of course, natural disasters and things like wars and famine are always going to be newsworthy and reportable. But whereas 20 years ago, if we went, the Ethiopian famine in the 1980s is an example, we would interview perhaps Western aid workers. These days, we very much try and interview the local support and the local authorities and so on in place. Issues of portrayal like that, I think, as I said, are becoming increasingly important. But also in terms of giving a rounded view of the world, I think people in the United States and in Europe need to understand how important the economies, and Asia's a good example, India's a good example with the IT industry and the outsourcing and so on that's going on there. The economies of other parts of the world touch their lives very directly now, and people need to understand the rounded picture of what's happening in other parts of the world.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio, sitting in for Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about globalization of the media today. My guests are Richard Sambrook, CEO of BBC World and director of the BBC's Global News Division. Oliver Boyd Barrett is with us, a professor of communication at California State University in Pomona. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Alan is on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Alan.
Hi, interesting conversation. I want to highlight the use of the Google News feature, what I use almost every day. When you click on it, you put in a keyword, and it'll pull up lots of stories. I've noticed that when the AP runs a story, you see it hundreds and hundreds of times across the U.S., not only in newspapers, but in TV stations, oftentimes watered down. And it shows you sometimes how much little reporting is going on, just being rehashed over and over. Now, they do have things like Al Jazeera and Jinhao from China, and of course they'll have their own opinion or editing of the news, but I just wanted to mention Google.
All right, thanks for the call, Alan. He raises, of course, the echo effect, the fact that it seems like there's a lot of sources, but really at the top there are two or three, four or five, given consolidation, who are generating the news, and everything else is derivative.
Yeah, Frank, if I could just come in there.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing about Google News, of course, is that it's an algorithm. It's basically automated. And what Google are now trying to do is to build into that algorithm something about the reliability of the sources so that it doesn't just throw up anything. And therefore, I think they're trying to weight the service towards, those news organizations which have some reputation for accuracy and trust and so on. But it raises a bigger issue as well for all of us in the news business, which is if an automated system like that can provide something which, as your caller said, is of real value to him and he checks it every day, where is the the value of the human judgment and mediation and intervention. And, you know, obviously I would argue there is a judgment in having people make those decisions about what's newsworthy and how to present it and how to explain the context and so on. But there's no question that there is a kind of commoditization of news going on in some ways, and the Internet is obviously at the forefront of that.
Now, when we come back from a short break, we're going to finish this exploration of global media with a conversation from the Minister of Information from Venezuela, which is helping to launch a regional network of its own this summer. And what happened to the former Special Forces soldier convicted of running his own prison in Afghanistan? Reporter Peter Bergen fills us in. I'm Frank Stachow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News, part of Think Global, Public Radio's week of special coverage. Today we're talking about the globalization of the media and how you get your news about the world. And we're asking, how global is your news? You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-989-TALK or sending us an email at totn@npr.org. And right now we're going to talk about an emerging news service. Latin America has a news network of its own, and it's called Telesur. Telesur is a channel that is going to begin to broadcast later this summer in many parts of South and Central America. The goal is covering news with a decidedly regional point of view. The government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is footing a portion of the network's cost. And here to tell us more about the network is Venezuela's Minister of Information, Andres Isarra. He joins us by phone from his office in Caracas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. How are you?
I'm fine. Tell us a little bit about the name.
Well, Telesur, it's not just a station to broadcast news. I mean, it will be, have much of its programming based on news, but we will be also broadcasting some of the programming that shows our regional characteristics or what the region is about, its different expressions. It is also an initiative of integration among the different countries of the region. We are planning to launch a test signal on May 24th. Then on July 24th, we will start with our newscast, and we will have a full launch of our signal by mid-September this year.
So tell us a little bit about the programming. What kinds of programs are you going to do?
We're going to have news. We will have documentaries, movies. Latin America has a great history of film production. We will have some sports and some other programming for typical of different countries. Where we have more than 1,000 hours of different programming that's coming in from Argentina. As you know, Argentina owns 20% of Telesur. We'll have also some programming from Brazil, from Cuba, from Colombia.
Well, tell me, do you see this as a business venture largely, or is this a real attempt to counter what you might think is cultural dominance by other media?
Yes, it's not a business venture. It's more of an integration effort. We think, we feel we need communication in order to integrate effectively among the countries and the regions who are walking that path. You know, together with Telesur, we're launching Petrosur, which is an initiative to coordinate, to integrate our different energy, state-owned energy companies. And this is in the framework of ALBA, which we're launching against ALCA, which is the Free Trade Agreement of the America, or NAFTA, as it's known by its initials in English. So we're proposing ALBA, which is the Bolivarian Integration Initiative for the Americas, that differentiates itself in its proposal consistently from what NAFTA is trying to do.
So in terms of news, though, so let's just take news as an example. Will you have editors and reporters from other countries all feeding into this one network? Or will they all be Venezuelan?
But basically what we're getting right now, when we hear about Argentina, when we want to know about Argentina, we tune into CNN or CNN Spanish, which gives you a very American perspective of what's going on in Argentina because of the way the news is being treated in the United States. So we want to see what's happening in Argentina and covered by journalists from Argentina and from Latin America to have a different view of the news of what's going on there.
Have you determined what kind of a market? I mean, is there a need for this? What have viewers told you?
Well, we've been so far. We've been very successful in distributing the signal. We have different agreements with different cable operators, but as well with regional TV stations all over the region. Colombia, in Brazil, in Argentina, Channel 7 from Argentina, which is the national public station, will broadcast some of our newscasts and some other block of programming. We think we have a potential of viewership of around 20 to 30 million people.
Oliver Boyd Barrett is still with us, a professor of communications at California State. I wonder, as you listen to this proposal, whether we were talking about globalization of the news, but are we talking about more niche programming, each sort of region of the world talking more to its own audience, or do you see a trend toward, as you hear this proposal, a trend toward all of us talking to each other about what's going on everywhere?
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Frank. I think that's a good point. This could be another instance of the fragmentation of media markets. But let me first say, though, that I believe many people would welcome greater diversity of voices in the international news system. And I would also say, referring back to a comment I made earlier in the program, that this is in this initiative, the Telesur initiative, is in a long and worthy tradition of attempts to set up alternative voices, that is, to the main Western-based voices in the news. And if I think back across earlier attempts of this kind, I would say that those that are the more successful tend to be the ones where, even if there is a government connection, they manage to control that government connection somehow. So, for example, Agence France-Presse is partly government-financed, but these days not too many people worry so much about that, because I think they know that the structure of Agence France-Presse incorporates the voices of news media as well as of journalists.
Andres, let me put that question. I'm going to stop you there and put the question to Andres Isara, who is, after all, the Minister of Information in Venezuela. How big a role is the Venezuelan government going to play in news production?
Well, Telesur is based in Caracas. The main facility will be based here. The Venezuelan government owns 50% of Telesur. 20% is owned by Argentina. Another 20% is owned by Cuba, and another 10% by Uruguay. We're trying to expand our capital base so Brazil can have also a share, and so we can have a multinational company running the station. In that way, we are trying to have the, as the professor was saying, the majority of voices that we can have, so editorially we can manage all the issues in a more different way or more plural way.
All right. Well, Andres, I want to thank you very much. We're out of time, but I appreciate you taking this time with us, the Minister of Information for the Government of Venezuela. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank my other guest as well, Oliver Boyd Barrett, Professor of Communications at California State University. Mark Nykerk was with us, Managing Editor at the Cincinnati Post. Richard Sandbrook, CEO of BBC World. Thank you all for being with us. Coming up, another global story, or a global story of a different kind, the story of Jack Edema. Stay with us.